Hi guys and welcome. Today we're going to be looking at three more avant-garde art movements. The first is neoplasticism, the second is Dada, and the third is going to be surrealism. So let's go ahead and get started on slide one where you're going to be taking notes. So neoplasticism is a term adopted by the Dutch pioneer of abstract art, Piet Mondrian. And so for Mondrian, he created abstract painting which only used horizontal and vertical lines, as well as primary colors. His work is very recognizable. I am certain you've seen it before. So while living in Paris, he was exposed to various strands of avant-garde art, in particular Cubism. Cubism was really something that he connected with. So he practiced making non-referential images. And what non-referential means is something's referential, there's something about it that you can unlock meaning to. You can see a symbol and you can understand it to mean something. Basically, you look at something and you can immediately connect it to something. So if something's non-referential, it doesn't have a reference attached to it. It's free of references. So just wanted to clear that term up so it has more meaning for you. So anyways, Mondrian, he practiced making non-referential images. And he did this by using lines and geometric elements that play a role in his compositions, but they don't have any apparent connection to anything in the visual world. His art is consciously constrained. So one thing that we talk about a lot with art is like people add things into art. More lines, more shapes, more of something. But with Mondrian, we have the opposite. We have a reductive technique. Things are being simplified or reduced away. So he really does celebrate the restrictions of a painting in this rectilinear format. Neoplasticism was, in fact, an ideal art in which the basic elements of painting, color, line, and form, were used only in their purest, most fundamental state. The only colors we see are primary colors, red, blue, and yellow, and non-colors, white, black, and gray. Shapes are in their purest, most fundamental shape, so just squares and rectangles. And as far as lines go, we only see horizontal or vertical lines. The inventors of Cubism, who you now know, both Braque and Picasso, they pushed beyond the frontiers established by Cézanne's late paintings. But they didn't take that final step to pure abstraction. Mondrian will be one of the artists that finally make this particular move. But Mondrian wasn't alone. Think back to Kandinsky with early abstraction. Kandinsky, like Mondrian, were also painting abstractions at the same time. So this is an example of art happening at the same time, moving in different directions. It's not like a chronological movement of art movements. So anyways, what's different about Mondrian in terms of abstraction is he does continue in the spirit of logic that was connected to the Cubist movement. So with the Cubists were representing the world as they see it, just in a visually different way. And Mondrian is in that spirit where he is representing things that he can see in the world, but in a different way. Whereas someone like Kandinsky is painting like inner emotions and feelings, like those intangible sensations that you get from sound and music. Mondrian is more logical and rational than that. He's reducing things to their simplest terms, but they're intended to be logical things of this world. So during his time in Paris around 1912, Mondrian becomes familiar with Cubism and he falls under the spell of Cubism. So it also connects to his efforts to reduce his compositions to their purest, simplest, and yet most potent possible state. This demonstrates that Mondrian well understood that art as a creative act has as much to do with subtraction as it has to do with addition. So composition in this sense, because I've used this word a couple times and I want to kind of clarify, with Kandinsky, composition was about music, putting together like a musical score. In this sense, we're back to our traditional artistic understanding of composition, where it's the choices an artist makes when they're arranging everything together in their painting. So since I'm throwing Kandinsky in this conversation, I wanted to clarify those two particular meanings. Okay, so Mondrian has an aim where he wants to remove every element that doesn't contribute directly and vitally to the essential form and the meaning of his work. So he's going to approach painting in a completely conceptual way. His paintings are the result of a rational process rather than spontaneous activity. And furthermore, their subject is an idea, not necessarily something that you perceive through like your emotions or your opinions or your perspective. Colors, as I mentioned, are restricted to the three primaries. Shapes can be, they can vary, but they're always going to be rectangular and typically defined by horizontal and vertical black lines. Mondrian consistently refined and simplified his paintings, and his canvases were usually square or rectangular, and the compositions were always organized around a single large dominating rectangle, which you'll definitely see in this painting. Ours is like more of a square, but you will see one shape that kind of dominates the entire canvas. Okay, you can go ahead and move to slide two. I'm going to talk about the painting, but what I want you to do is you'll notice that you have pieces of the painting. I want you to put the painting together, kind of drag and drop and assemble the painting. I want you guys to do this because I want to force you guys to look at detail. I want you guys to hopefully make this painting more memorable. And I just want to move beyond the fact that, yes, this is a painting of a bunch of squares. I want you guys to really like understand the surface and the formal qualities of this painting. So right now you guys can organize the image. So composition with red, blue, and yellow. Or remember, composition as arrangement, not necessarily like physical arrangement, not necessarily like a musical arrangement, is dominated by a large red square. It's not a perfect square, so I guess we could refer to that as a rectangle, but you have a large red shape. So this was developed by Mondrian around 1930. And then the painting is basically delineated by, you can see black horizontal and vertical lines. You can also see that there is a blue shape in the bottom left corner. We have crisscrossing black bars that are displaced far from the center, and they meet at the corners of the painting. And then we have that deep blue area and that primary yellow that also punctuate the surface of this painting. So what you're looking at here is the elements of art reduced to their most purest state. Remember this idea of subtraction to make art, not reduction. We have the primary colors. We have the non-color colors, black and white. And then we have the most basic elements of shape, square and rectangle. And we also have the purest form of line, vertical and horizontal. Okay, now that you've done a lot of looking, go ahead and move to slide three. So Mondrian typically applied his paint in very flat, even layers. So there's basically no evidence of the brush. In most paintings, you can look up close and you can kind of see lines or you can kind of see the direction of the brush. But this almost looks like a printed surface. It's very flat. So simplicity, order, having exact definition of all parts of the painting, having balance, having a basic linear structure, and having an insistence on flatness can describe Mondrian's work. So his aesthetic objective was to obtain an arrangement of balanced contrast. So the balanced contrasts we have here are the non-colors with the primary colors, with the vertical and the horizontal lines. Mondrian sought to give expression through this absolute harmony between all the elements you see here. And he achieves the harmony with the contrast that he's presented in this artwork. So Mondrian extended the range of human expression, human experience. He invented new forms as appropriate metaphors for his experience. Because remember, the things he's representing are things inspired by the world he lives in. At one point, Mondrian will move to New York. He has a painting, which I'll add to this slide, called Broadway Boogie Woogie. And what it's supposed to be is kind of like the experience of moving through New York, the streets, the skyscrapers, those types of things. So though we're looking at this and we're like, all these paintings look exactly alike, they do represent individual, unique things. It's just because the language and the tools from which he uses to express these are so reductive that we try to say they all look the same or they mean the same thing. They each have their own individual messages. So the forms that he created now are definitely important in terms of art. Someone once famous art critic made the remark that Mondrian always paints one and the same picture, but this picture lies beyond the frontiers of art, meaning that his artwork on the surface may have many similarities to each other, but what they represent kind of extends outside of the experience of art. So perhaps once upon a time, that art critic definitely shared the feelings of what an art world was seeing with this new art. But now we view Mondrian as kind of like a cornerstone in the foundation of what would become modern art. So like Cézanne, like all truly creative men and artists, Mondrian taught us to see our world a little differently than we did before. He really worked on a technique that created these reductive forms and shapes and lines and colors in his art that gave a new visual means in order to see a new world. And by new world, remember, we're always talking about the modern era. The world is changing, and artists like Mondrian and those who came before him in modern art movements are looking for the visual terms to describe a new world and a new way to see this world. All right, you can go ahead and move to slide 4, which we're going to learn about a movement called Dada. So if there's one anti-movement in the history of art, it's Dada. And so the name is nonsensical. It's not supposed to mean anything. You're not supposed to analyze it and figure out what it means. It's really just kind of a random, spontaneous term. So Dada had aims which were related to being random, the aim of total freedom of expression, being absurd, and just totally abandoning all the conventions of art. Although we've seen art that has been a reaction or kind of rebels against what came before it, this is intended to displace all established art. So it still operated like many avant-garde movements that we've been learning about. It was highly theoretical. It was textually based or had like a manifesto proclaiming what it believed in or how this art functioned. It had leaders, things like that. But the roots of Dada actually are found in the radical cafes in Paris of the late 19th century, where there was all kinds of bizarre anti-bourgeois behavior. And people would engage in kind of like performances and conversations, basically collaborative activities where people would be instigated into conversation or argument. Like, there's a lot of interesting Dada artists who would like read poetry, dress up in funky costumes, basically just challenge the norms of European society. So Dada's aesthetic, it's kind of hard to describe. You can't make a list of what Dada artwork looks like, but it is marked by its mockery of materialistic and nationalistic attitudes. It proved to be a very powerful influence on artists in many cities, including Berlin, Hanover, Paris, New York, and Cologne, all which generated their own form of Dada. So the movement dissipated with the establishment of Surrealism, but the ideas it gave rise to have become cornerstones of various categories of both modern and contemporary art. All right, go ahead and move to slide 5. Okay, so before we get to the artwork in the 250, there's kind of a new concept with art that I'm going to introduce you to, and that is something called the ready-made. And so a ready-made is exactly what it sounds like. Something is already made. So artists in the Dada movement basically like to use ordinary prefabricated objects. They selected these objects, and then they would present these objects as art. Sometimes the object would be altered, such as combining it with another object to make it an assisted ready-made. The very first ready-made consisted of a bicycle wheel mounted upside down on the seat of a stool. So essentially, it renders the entire object unusable. You're not supposed to use a ready-made. It's supposed to make you think of something, or maybe remember its intended use, or think of some concept that surrounds this. But essentially, you kind of ask yourself, like, what are you supposed to make of this object? Why does this qualify as art? Is any object a potential ready-made? Can anyone make one? And a lot of times, this is the point of the school year where students will start saying, like, well, why is that art? I could make that. And the answer is always the same thing, and it's a pretty simple answer. It's, well, you didn't make it first. So these ready-mades weren't intended to be something that, like, lasted forever. It was supposed to be, like, a moment in art where people turned a corner and were making things new that connected to new ideas. The artist we're going to look at next, Duchamp, he recognized that ready-mades have power, but he also recognized that they would diminish with proliferation. So he only made 13. So the technique of creating art by carefully selecting and combining already made objects has proven to be enormously fruitful for other artists. So sculptures based on found objects have flourished since Dada, and it will through the 1950s. And although ready-mades remain controversial for many members of the general public, it's undoubtedly true that the contemporary art world now value artists' concepts much more than their technical skills. So essentially what I'm pointing to there is what a ready-made forces you to do is think more about the concept of the artwork versus the actual physical artwork itself. And I think this will become more clear when we look at the artwork from the 250 Fountain by Marcel Duchamp. So go ahead and go to slide 6 where you'll be taking notes. So what we're looking at is a urinal. So what Duchamp does is he gets a urinal, he signs it Armut, he puts a date on it, and he submits it to an exhibition in New York. He moved from Paris to New York, and he was participating in the art world. And so this particular exhibition said that it was going to accept all artwork, and they saw his artwork, and they rejected it. So although this exhibition's kind of breaking its rules, Duchamp got frustrated, and he published an anonymous reaction to this artwork getting rejected from the exhibition. And in it he says, whether Mr. Mutt, because it was signed Armut, with his own hands made the fountain or not has no importance. He chose it. He took an ordinary article of life and placed it so that its useful significance disappeared under the new title and point of view. He created a new thought for that object. And that's from Marcel Duchamp, building a case for this artwork back in 1917. So when he submitted it to this New York exhibition, he submitted it in the category of sculpture. So when you think about sculpture, I mean, sculpture has a grand tradition. I mean, think about Doryphorus, the spear bearer. Think of Seated Boxer, Nike of Samothrace, the Burghers of Calais. Sculpture has this grand tradition where it's heroic, it's monumental, it has deep meaning for people, and the stories connected to it. It's very hard to connect Duchamp's fountain to this grand tradition. So let's try to talk about this artwork as art. So if we were to talk about some of the formal qualities, it almost sounds like kind of like a joke. So let me try to give that an attempt. We're looking at an object, that is an organic shape. It has a solid white color. It has a glossy texture or surface. It's smooth. It's symmetrical. It has curved lines. I mean, it's almost funny talking about it in this way. So art is typically a practice of transformation. An artist takes ordinary materials, whether that's a block of marble, pigments, paints, a canvas, a wall, a surface, whatever it may be, and they make us see things in a new way. They kind of transport us to a different place. So with urinal, Marcel Duchamp doesn't go through that process that we expect with an artist. He doesn't make anything. He technically didn't do anything to achieve this end product, but he's doing something else. He's asking us to see the urinal in a new way. So he's really tapping into something more cerebral, more conceptual. And that's why this artwork is so important. It's really the first conceptual artwork. Now, when you look at a timeline of art history, there's the most important works in the history of art where something is created and nothing is ever the same. Contrapposto, Da Vinci in the Renaissance, Mona Lisa, Cubism. On that timeline, Dada, Marcel Duchamp, The Fountain, that is a huge moment in the history of art. Because what has happened here is Duchamp is making a statement that the artist doesn't need to make the physical artwork. The artist just needs to create the concept. And so what's happened in this transition is Duchamp is putting the emphasis on the concept. Artists can create concepts. Artists can shape thoughts. The artist doesn't have to be technical. And that's a big shift in terms of art. This artwork definitely makes us think, what is art? Is craftsmanship required? Does something need to be beautiful in order for you to appreciate it and make it art? It throws everything out the window in terms of what we know about art with its absurdity. This is an artwork you can ask many questions about. Does art have to be made by the hand of the artist? So if not, is art the object? Is art the idea? Is art the concept? I think Duchamp would say art is the idea, and it is the concept, and it's shaped by the artist, but he doesn't necessarily have to create the object at hand. So I'm going to read that line I read you guys earlier in this part of the lecture, where Marcel Duchamp is defending himself, and hopefully has like a little bit more meaning for you. Whether Mr. Mutt with his own hands made the fountain or not has no importance. He chose it. He took an ordinary article of life and placed it so that its useful significance disappeared under the new title and point of view. He created a new thought for the object. So in terms of why this is art, this is the first conceptual artwork. This is an artwork that the artist intentionally creates a thought, not creates the object. And it shows us that art can exist in the concept, without the art necessarily existing in the artist's craftsmanship and technical skill. All right, so go ahead and move to slide 7. To unpack this idea and reinforce it, I want you guys to write basically notes or a short summary. Why is Duchamp's fountain art? What makes this art? So I'll give you a few moments to take care of that. Please make sure you're addressing this idea of concept, and also make sure you're addressing the idea of how Duchamp is basically taking away what's most important to the artist for the whole entire tradition of art history, the craftsmanship, the technical skill. Okay, now let's go ahead and get ready to go to slide 8, where we're going to learn about Surrealism. So Surrealism actually began as a literary movement. So the first writings about Surrealism kind of come to be within a manifesto. And this manifesto wasn't for visual artists, but it was intended for literary circles, but eventually it evolves into a visual movement as well. So André Breton in 1924 wrote a manifesto where he called for the poetics of the unconscious, of the mental world outside of the control of reason and social organization. So for Breton, the unconscious world was real and very much so susceptible to visual representation. Breton and those aligned with Surrealism, they valued literary and visual representations that were based on hallucinations, dreams, nightmares, spontaneity, and other manifestations of the unconscious. So what these artists and writers at this time were trying to find a way to break free from rules, structures, things embedded in the logical world, and they're trying to find ways to tap into the subconscious. So Surrealism, and the artists of Surrealism, they began to create new strategies for making art that revealed the unconscious, visualizing and doing so the secrets of imagination. Surrealism was, like realism, impressionism, symbolism, and cubism, movement that was basically widespread. It was profound, and it had a prolonged effect on the world of art. The global reach of surrealism was also ensured by what was happening at the world at this time. There was chaos from global depressions, there was the world wars, and so Europeans, Americans, actually people of the world in this era, kind of feel like the world doesn't make sense. People are starting to let go of logic because so many bad things have happened. People start to try to make a good connection. I wish I could make a connection to what's happening in the world now. When what you depend on and what's logical disappears, sometimes you become more interested in deeper, more spiritual matters. And I think people were looking for meaning in the world in many other different ways. So the first artist we're going to take a look at is Merritt Oppenheim. So you can go ahead and move to slide 9. What's interesting about the 250 is two of the three surrealist artworks that you guys have are created by women. And it's ironic because in surrealism, women were very much the subjects and muses of surrealism. Men definitely dominated this movement. Among them, Salvador Dali, Man Ray, René Magritte, who are very famous artists, who I'm sure you've seen some of their work, whether you know it or not. So it's notable that Merritt Oppenheim made a place for herself as one of surrealism's central artists, and she produced some of their most powerful works. She lived in Paris, was at the center of the surrealism movement, and was an active member in the group. She had solo exhibitions, and it was funny because many critics and admirers of her work referred to her as Mr. Oppenheim because they didn't realize that she was a female artist. She was aware of how women were regarded within her surrealist movement and society, so she kind of just took the gender confusion as like kind of like a humorous thing. So her work is definitely embedded with humor, eroticism, menacing darkness. Her work also reflects her critical explorations of female sexuality, female identity, and female exploitation. So her most famous artworks are assemblages, which is kind of like a collage, you put objects together, sculptural works. And then in these assemblages and sculptural works, she brings together domestic items, which always connect to female and gender. And she kind of juxtaposes them with things that are disturbing and humorous. For the surrealists, these kinds of objects crack the veneer of civilized society, and they revealed the sexual, psychological, emotional drives that are beneath the surface of logic. Also, something to know about surrealism is a lot of surrealist ideas connect to the ideas of Freud, where like dreams and memories and past experiences have meaning. So the object of the 250, well, the object, it's called the object, and it is an object, so maybe that's why this is like a funny reference, is basically a sensational teacup. This is Oppenheim's object. It all began with a joke over lunch. In 1936, Oppenheim was at a Paris cafe with Dora Maar and Pablo Picasso, and they noticed a fur-lined polished metal bracelet that Oppenheim was wearing, and they joked that anything could be covered with fur. Like, if this bracelet could be covered with fur, then anything could. So then Oppenheim said, well, even this cup and saucer. And so she carried this kind of humor a little further, and she called out to the waiter, "Waiter, more fur." So this kind of sparked her imagination. And she, not long after the meal, goes to a department store, bought a white teacup, a saucer, and a spoon, and wrapped them in the speckled tan fur of Chinese gazelle. And then she titled this object. So what she's doing here is she transforms a traditional item that's associated with decorum, feminine refinement, and she creates this kind of puzzling surrealist sculpture. And so what I mean by that is when you think of a teacup, you think of delicacy, you think of being a lady, you think about the teacup goes on a certain side of the plate on the table. There's something very feminine connected to manners, politeness, society, that, you know, these are ideas that all connect to a teacup. And so a teacup has all of that embedded meaning, and now the fur is going to add some additional meaning into that. Go ahead and move to slide 10. So object exemplifies André Breton's argument that with surrealism, mundane things can be presented in unexpected ways. And, you know, this can also challenge reason. So the urge to basically reveal the things that we keep hidden can connect to our subconscious. And so basically what Oppenheim is trying to do is she's trying to take an everyday object and have people look at it and bring other meaning to it. So this causes a sensation when it was introduced to the public in 1936. It was first in an exhibition of surrealist objects in Paris, and then it was shown in New York, and people called it the fur-lined cup school of art. That's how they referred to the exhibit after seeing Oppenheim's object. And so I think that headline really captures the mixture of bemusement, offense, shock, and fascination that this fur-lined teacup offers. Many viewers cannot comprehend or understand or just justify why this was constituted as art. So Oppenheim once wrote that art has nothing to do with decoration. Art has to do with spirit. And a work as small and economical as object had such outsized spirit because fur combined with a teacup evokes a surprising mix of messages and associations. So a way to think about this is the art isn't necessarily, well, the art exists in the object. She put the artwork together. However, the art also exists in the reaction and the associations you find with it. So for example, some people might look at this object and they might think of wild animals in nature. Some people could look at the teacup and think of manners and civilization. With its pelt, the teacup becomes soft. It becomes rounded and highly tactile. It seems attractive to the touch, if not on the other hand, I guess on the opposite hand to the taste. Imagine drinking this. It's kind of a gross experience, but you're supposed to. That's part of this artwork. Think about it. If you were to drink out of this cup, pour some liquid into it, pick up this furry teacup and drink out of it, you would have this physical sensation of wet fur filling the mouth. And it's intended to make you react. It's intended to make you think. It's intended for you to bring some meaning to that. Some people have positive associations with this. Some people have negative associations with this. I've even heard people talk about this artwork in terms of like tea. Tea is supposed to give you this warm, kind of nurtured feeling. Fur also can have that meaning, or it can make you feel comfortable and warm, like a cup of tea. But when you put those two things together, like object, a fur-lined teacup, it could have a totally contrasting image. So there's no singular answer as to what this artwork is and what exactly it means, but there is a singular answer to what this artwork does. It allows you to, well, it evokes mixed messages and associations. It's trying to untap something beneath the surface that is beyond logic. It's trying to connect to your emotions, your memories, your associations, all of those things that you connect to when you try to understand and unpack this artwork. And surrealism really does that. It takes things to the extreme with the possibility of interpretation. All right, next you can move to slide 11. We're going to be taking a look at Frida Kahlo. So Frida Kahlo is a Mexican surrealist, very famous artist. Most students know a lot about Frida Kahlo before we actually get to her artwork. She was influenced, as I mentioned, by the surrealists in Europe, and then also a group of artists that were in Mexico. And the way she connects to surrealism is her artwork is an expression of her psyche, of her emotions, of her pain, of her memories, of past, present, and future. You can learn a lot about Frida Kahlo's life just by looking at her artwork. So something people like to point out about her artwork is facial hair, her unibrow. A lot of people look at that and they're like, immediately, that's very Frida Kahlo. So this was an era where women were still wearing elaborate hairstyles, hosiery, attire. Kahlo was more of a rebellious loner. She kind of existed outside of like those trends and kind of took on her own. She's often dressed in indigenous clothing. So sometimes when you look at her painting, she's dressed in indigenous Mexican clothing. Other times it's more European. In the painting we're looking at here, we kind of have both. So moreover, she lived as an artist during a period where many middle-class women sacrificed their ambitions to be a good housewife, to live in the domestic sphere. So she basically tossed out the conventions of beauty and social expectations within her self-portraits. And so her images, I think, are so well received because there's so much honesty and authenticity. She explores complex and difficult topics. She explores her mixed cultural heritage, the harsh reality of her medical conditions, and the repression of women. She had some associations to the communist group in Mexico, so she's definitely looking towards like how gender equity could exist in society and a lot of other different things. I definitely recommend, if you have time, watching the Frida movie, the one that stars Salma Hayek. One, it's just a very visually beautiful movie. The director directed The Lion King and just a lot of things that have beautiful visual qualities. So it's very, it's like watching a work of art, but it's also just a really well done biopic. If you have time, make sure you guys take a look at that. All right, so back to the artwork from the 250. We're looking at a double self-portrait with the two Fridas. So what we see is two seated figures holding hands. They're sharing a bench and they're in front of a stormy sky. The Fridas are identical except for their attire, which is a poignant issue for Kahlo at this moment when she painted this. She painted this canvas the year she was divorced from Diego Rivera, and he's probably the most famous Mexican artist beside Frida Kahlo. So Diego Rivera cheated on her a lot. It's well documented, even like with her sister, her friends, like he was just very unfaithful. But Frida Kahlo keeps reconnecting with him over time. And so there's just something very important about that relationship between she and Diego Rivera. And he appears in many of her artworks, and he makes an appearance in this one, which we'll take a look at in a moment. Go ahead and move to slide 12 for more notes. So before she married Rivera in 1929, she wore modern European clothing. This is definitely evident in the self-portrait on this slide, where she's donning a red velvet dress with gold embroidery, very European outfit. With Rivera's encouragement, Kahlo began to learn and embrace Mexican customs, indigenous customs, and that becomes reflected in her art as well. It's really easy to see with her clothing. So in the second self-portrait I have here, her accessories reference distinct periods in Mexican history. Her necklace is a reference to pre-Columbian jadeite of the Aztecs, and the earrings are colonial in style. And her white blouse is a nod to indigenous Mexican women. So she has all these layers that she's demonstrating this affinity for local attire. The portraits from the 1930s reflect Kahlo's growing penchant for indigenous attire and hairstyling. And it's very evident in Frida and Diego Rivera, 1931. I have that one listed. And in the two Fridas. Kahlo never abandoned dressing her subjects and herself in mainstream European dress. She just seemed to kind of infuse it along with the indigenous Mexican dress as well. And we can kind of see some of this in the painting, My Grandparents, My Parents and I. In this painting, the bridal dress that Kahlo's mother wears is reminiscent of the white stiff collar dress the artist wears in the two Fridas. So it's kind of like a grotesque view into each woman's insides, and it's really heightened by the whiteness of both dresses. In her brief lifetime, Kahlo painted about 200 works of art, many of which are self-portraits. With the exception of a few family trees, the double portrait with Rivera and the two Fridas, This painting really represents a departure in her overall scope of painting. So if a self-portrait is defined as a person painting oneself, why would Kahlo paint herself twice? One way to answer this question is to take a look at the two Fridas as a bookend to the portrait Frida and Diego Rivera. Though this painting was meant to celebrate the birth of their union, their marriage, the way that Frida grasped Diego Rivera's hand seems to reflect Kahlo's misgivings about her husband's fidelity. By contrast, the double self-portrait, though laden with obvious suffering, exhibits resilience. Okay, go ahead and move to slide 13. Let me double check. Yeah, okay. Sorry, I get lost in these slide numbers. So what you're looking at is a double self-portrait. We see the two Fridas clasping hands tightly. And this bond is emphasized and echoed by the vein that unites them. Where one is weak because her heart is exposed, the other is strong. Where one pines for her lost love, which is underscored by, if you look at the vein, I have a detail of this here, it's feeding a mini portrait of Diego Rivera. The other clamps down on that vein with a figurative and literal tie with a medical device that's used for clamping veins, or is it arteries? You know what I mean? So basically she's like closing off her ability to bleed out and cause pain. She's trying to fix that. So human anatomy is graphically exposed in Kahlo's work. She addresses suicide. She addresses her miscarriages in her artwork. So her artwork can be really uncomfortable because she definitely goes there in terms of graphic displays of physical things. She knows a lot about pain and medical suffering. When she was a child, she had polio and it deformed one of her legs. She also was involved in a bus accident when she was 18. She almost died, but it left her incredibly disabled and unable to bear children. She had 32 operations as a result of the bus accident, and she was in bed, needed a hobby, and that's when she took up painting. It gave her something to do while she was lying in bed healing from this operation. So Kahlo utilized blood as a visceral metaphor of union. As in some of her family portraits, she honors her lineages through blood ties, and she also shows it as like a physical blood tie. She returns to this metaphor of blood ties in the two Fridas, but this time she adds impact by having two hearts. Both hearts are vulnerable because they're laid bare to the viewer, and it's supposed to be a testament to her emotional suffering. The solitude that she had with her frequent bed rest stemming from polio and her near-fatal bus accident was one of the cruel constants in Kahlo's life. She never fully recovered from her medical issues. She did live in a constant state of pain and suffering. And in numerous photographs featuring Kahlo in bed, it shows her like painting despite all of her restraints. And so painting became a way for her to cope through her pain and suffering, whether it was physical, bus accident, polio, or whether it was something more emotional, her tumultuous relationship with Diego Rivera. So the isolation caused by her health was always present. She reflected, and this is a quote from her, "I paint self-portraits because I'm so often alone, because I'm the person that I know best." Okay, go ahead and move to slide 14. On slide 14, I have some annotations that I'd like you guys to move around to the appropriate areas of the painting. So I'll give you guys a couple minutes to do that. And then we have one last artwork to look at, and it's our last surrealist artwork, although it does have some cubist tendencies. Okay, at this point, you should be finishing up your annotations. And the last artwork we're going to take a look at is Wilfredo Lam's The Jungle. So we're going to start off with the Godfather reference. Make sure that you guys are on slide 15 for notes. Okay, so in The Godfather Part 2, Michael Corleone has just the unfortunate timing of visiting Cuba on the eve of the 1959 revolution. This revolution would basically overthrow the corrupt government of Cuba's leader at the time, Batista. Corleone's stay in Havana, marked by business meetings with American corporations and trips to casinos and cabaret show, highlight the excesses that led to the dramatic fall of that regime during the film's New Year's Eve party. 15 years later, when Wilfredo Lam painted The Jungle, Cuba had already spent over 4 decades at the mercy of the interests of the United States. So Lam remains the most renowned painter from Cuba, and The Jungle remains his best-known work and an important painting in the history of Latin American art within 20th century modernism. In the 20s and 30s, Lam was in Madrid and Paris, but in 1941, as Europe was engulfed by war, he returned to Cuba. He would leave Cuba again for Europe after the war, but key elements within his artistic practice intersected during this period. Lam was conscious and really cared about Cuba's socioeconomic realities, and also his artistic formation in Europe exposed him to the influence of surrealism and to Cubism, and it reacquainted him with the Afro-Caribbean culture. So this collision resulted in the artist's most notable work, The Jungle. And that's really the most important part about this artwork. It really is a collision of a variety of styles. Remember that Cubism would not have happened without Picasso really taking a look at the African masks from the Trocadero show, with trying to find a way to represent the reality of chaos in modern society. So here, Lam is really putting together a lot of different factors and creating an artwork that represents that vision. So The Jungle has a cluster of kind of mysterious faces, limbs, and sugar cane that basically all crowd this canvas. It's an 8-foot square. This painting is a bold game of perception. He haphazardly constructs figures from a collection of distinct forms. We have crescent-shaped faces, rounded backsides, willowy arms and legs, and flat, clawed-ish hands and feet. When assembled, these figures kind of look like a funhouse mirror reflection. Everything's disproportionate, and the shapes create an uneasy balance between the very dense top of this painting and the more open bottom. There's not enough feet and legs to support the upper half of the painting. It almost looks like it's on the verge of toppling over. So another significant element within this game of perception is how Lam has placed these figures in an unorthodox landscape. Lam's panorama excludes the typical elements of a painting: a horizon line, a sky, a wide view. Instead, we have a tight, directionless snapshot, only with the faintest sense of ground. One part of the flora of the scene, the sugarcane, is kind of alien to the jungle setting as depicted in the painting's title. Sugarcane doesn't grow in the jungle. It's cultivated in fields. In the 1940s in Cuba, this points back to Lam's socioeconomic interest, sugarcane was a huge business. It required the hard labor of thousands of workers, and it had a connection in terms of like reputation, very similar to the cotton industry in the American South before the Civil War. The reality of laboring Cubans was in sharp contrast to how foreigners perceive this island nation. So Americans saw Cuba as like a playground. You go to clubs, you go to casinos, you live the good life. But the reality is a lot of people were working really hard, not making a lot of money, and being taken advantage of. Lam's painting remains as unusual Cuban landscape compared to tourism posters that depicted Cuba as the best destination for Americans seeking beachside resorts. While Northern visitors enjoyed a resort experience, U.S. corporations ran their businesses, including sugarcane production. Though Cuba gained independence from Spain at the end of the 19th century, the U.S. maintained the right to intervene in Cuba's affairs. And this caused a lot of destabilization of politics on the island for decades. So go ahead and move to slide 17. So let's kind of touch on European modernism and a couple other things. So during the interwar periods in Paris, Lamb befriended surrealists, and the surrealist influence is evident in The Jungle. Surrealists tried to release the unconscious mind. Suppression, they believed. Suppression by things that are rational and logical wasn't the best way to send a message in art. They wanted to achieve a different reality. So in art, the juxtaposition of irrational images reveal a super reality or surreality. Surreal, get it? In Lamb's work, we have that otherworldly, super reality, surreality atmosphere. And it basically emerges from the constant shifting that takes place when you're looking at this painting. Figures at once can be both human and animal, kind of organic and mystical. In terms of like cubism, this looks very cubist because of the way that cubists try to fragment the surface of an artwork, show multiple perspectives all at once. So the metamorphosis among the figures is also related to Lamb's interest in Afro-Caribbean culture. When he resettled in Cuba in 1941, he began to integrate symbols from Santeria, an Afro-Cuban religion that mixes African beliefs and customs along with Catholicism into his art. During Santeria ceremonies, the supernatural merges with the natural world through masks and through animals, and someone can be possessed by a god. These ceremonies are intended to be like a metamorphosis of being in the present, but also this departure to something otherworldly. Lamb creates a new narrative with the Cuban imagination. He roots it in the island's complex history. And he's also working hard to create an anecdote to the picturesque frivolity that mired the nation's stereotype. And here's a quote from him. "I refuse to paint Cuban cha-cha-cha. I wanted with all my heart to paint the drama of my country by thoroughly expressing the Negro spirit. In this way, I could act as a Trojan horse that would spew forth hallucinating figures with the power to surprise, to disturb the dreams of the exploiters. I knew I was running the risk of not being understood either by the man in the street or by others. But a true picture has the power to set the imagination to work, even if it takes time." So your takeaway from this artwork is that The Jungle is a conglomeration of Cubist stylistic influence, surrealism, Afro-Caribbean culture, and also a way to speak out about the socioeconomic causes that were close to Lamb's heart in his native Cuba. So The Jungle is both enigmatic and enchanting, and has inspired generations of viewers to liberate their imaginations.